Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the four-year anniversary of the FlixWise podcast. On today's show, we are forgoing the usual suspects and welcoming a very special guest. As I mentioned in one of the teases for this episode, if you have ever taken any film history or film studies course in your life, you're likely familiar with the work of today's esteemed co-panelist. He has authored or co-authored some of the most enduring and celebrated books on cinema history and form, including works such as Narration in the Fiction Film, On the History of Film Style, Poetics of Cinema, and of course, Film Art, which was the textbook used in my very first film studies class. It is my great pleasure to welcome to the show professor, scholar, and style icon, David Bordwell. Welcome, David.
Thank you. Glad you noticed that I never changed my clothes.
It's very true. Very kind of you to rock the white tuxedo jacket today.
What can I say? Me and Chow Yun-Fat, we just roll together.
Sure. Do people refer to you as a style icon? Because they should.
No, not really. In fact, as I've usually been able to feel that whenever I go anywhere, everyone is better dressed than me. So,
well, perhaps time to invest in, you know, Humphrey Bogart style, like power clashing and trench coats and stuff like that.
If they're at Goodwill, I could find them.
Oh, yes. Done. Okay. So David is on hand today to talk about his latest publication, Reinventing Hollywood, How 1940s Filmmakers Changed Movie Storytelling, which is a book that explores narrative techniques developed in the 1940s, as the title suggests. But to kick things off, we're going to start with a specific film from the era, Michael Curtiz's 1942 wartime romance, Casablanca. Possibly the quintessential Hollywood movie, not just of the 1940s, but of all time. Casablanca is the perfect distillation of the classical Hollywood style, or at least that's what its reputation would have us believe. However, since we have the expert on film style here, we're going to talk about some of the ways that it both typifies classical convention and also how its idiosyncrasies and surprising narrative choices are part of the reason it's such an enduring classic. Okay, so without further delay, shall we get to it?
Sure.
All right. Can I get, real quick, a Vive la France?
Vive la France.
Excellent. All right. A kiss is just a kiss. All right, Casablanca. I'm pretty sure most of you listening are familiar, at least somewhat familiar, with the plot of the film. But for those of you who missed that boat in Lisbon or got stuck in Oran or whatever, just been living under a rock, here's a real quick rundown of some of the stuff that Casablanca is made of. Also, different movie, whatever. When Warner Brothers released the film in 1942, their expectations for both critical acclaim and box office returns were limited. The film had been rushed into production, starting even before the script had been finalized. Then its release was moved up at the behest of the Warner's marketing team, who wanted the premiere to capitalize on the recent Allied invasion of Northern Africa. Seems ironic that a movie in which the characters primarily just wait and wait and wait should be so hurried in its schedule. But somehow, the breakneck freneticism of the production translated on screen to a sense of urgency. Thanks in part to this dramatic restlessness, what started out as a run-of-the-mill wartime drama has become one of the most enduring documents that Hollywood has ever put to celluloid. The film opens with a prologue meant to simulate a World War II newsreel. The narration details how the whole of Europe has been imprisoned by fascist dictatorships, and those looking to escape must make haste towards the Americas. The voiceover and corresponding visuals illustrate the European émigrés' treacherous journey through the rim of Africa in order to catch a ship bound for the United States. It explains that the primary route involves heading south from Europe through the Mediterranean to Algeria, to French Morocco, and then finally to Portugal, where one can find passage to the west. However, émigrés cannot simply hop on a plane from French Morocco to Portugal, as the area is under the control of the Vichy government. The only way out is by securing either letters of transit or exit visas from local law enforcement in a city called Casablanca. Of course, these exit visas aren't easy to come by, so many get stuck in Casablanca, waiting for their ticket to freedom. And so it begins. One of the greatest love stories ever told kicks off with a mishap involving stolen paperwork. How romantic. It seems that two signed letters of transit have been taken and are floating around somewhere in Casablanca, likely to be sold by some shady dealer on the black market. Apparently, these letters are important enough that a high-ranking Nazi official named Major Strasser
played by Conrad Veidt, has flown down from Berlin to investigate the missing documents. At the airport, he is met by the jocular Captain Louis Renault, played by Claude Rains. Major Strasse also reveals that the letters aren't the only reason he made the trek down to Africa. He's also gotten word that one of the major figures of the resistance, Victor Laszlo, who's played by Paul Henreid, is headed to Casablanca with his wife, and Strasse's main goal is to ensure that those missing letters of transit don't end up in Laszlo's hands. And now, at long last, we get to the part of the story we all know and must remember. The love story between the craggy club owner, the eponymous Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart, and his favorite corrupt official, Louis. Oh, wait. And it turns out there's some history between Rick and Victor Laszlo's wife as well. Ilsa, played by Ingrid Bergman. Before Rick started running a gambling parlor in Morocco, he was a mercenary who always seemed to end up on the losing side of any battle he fought. But something happened to Rick that turned him into a firm isolationist, and he now refuses to take side in this European conflict. Through a flashback, we learn that Rick wasn't always so cynical. Just prior to the German invasion of France, Rick was living in Paris, where he met and fell in love with Ilsa, and together they made plans to leave Europe as the Nazis started pouring into the city. However, when it came time to book it out of town, Ilsa left Rick standing alone on a train platform with a letter explaining that he should go on without her. Flash forward, Rick and Ilsa meet once again in Casablanca. He, now a ruthless, pragmatist saloon keeper, she, an honor-bound wife tied to Victor, a man who's dependent on her for love and support as he fights for liberation. Victor and Ilsa need passage to Lisbon so that Victor can carry out his work. Rick and Ilsa need passage to Lisbon so that they can carry on their romance. Major Strasse needs Victor either locked up or held in Casablanca indefinitely. And Louis, well, Louis just needs a stiff drink. It's an impressive array of plot threads that all inexplicably weave together to form one of the most satisfying conclusions in cinema history. In the end, Rick all but buckles Ilsa and Victor's seatbelts as he sends them off on a plane bound to Lisbon, thereby sacrificing his own personal happiness for the sake of the global good. Rick then officially joins the Allied cause when he shoots Major Strasse and turns himself over to Louis. Then, just when we think Rick is doomed to a concentration camp, good old Louis, presumably inspired by Rick's act of heroism, covers for Rick when the Nazis come to investigate Major Strasse's murder. Louis and Rick then set off for Brazzaville to fight alongside the resistance, thus beginning their beautiful friendship. The tight knitting of these narratives is something of a minor miracle, particularly given that everything was put together at the last minute. The primary credited screenwriters are the Epstein brothers, Julius and Philip, but they were not the only contributors to the story. The script passed through approximately a half dozen writers' hands before going into production, and yet somehow it's all assembled with perfect narrative efficiency and cohesion. Chalk it up to directorial authority, the glamour of the actors, or perhaps just movie magic. Casablanca's depiction of noble sacrifice and wistful romance remains a perennial favorite. But after all these years, what's left to say about Casablanca that hasn't been said before? We'll see if we can come up with something. I suppose the fundamentals still apply, right, David?
Yeah.
Okay, so where to begin? Shall we start in the middle and then flashback, or okay? Well, actually, let's start at the beginning. So, David, when did you first see Casablanca?
You know, that's interesting. I don't remember first seeing Casablanca at all. It's a film that was sort of important for my generation and the generation slightly ahead of mine, the Woody Allen generation, as it was really becoming a kind of iconic film in the '60s, I think. With a kind of cult of Humphrey Bogart. There was a sort of growing sense that he was an underrated Hollywood actor. And about the same time as people were discovering W.C. Fields, Marx Brothers, and other items of studio Hollywood. And around about, it seems to me, the 1960s, people started to think of Casablanca as this prototypical romantic film. And I think Woody Allen kind of cemented that with Play It Again, Sam. And the cult of Bogie and then the general cult of the 40s look in terms of fashion and behavior, all those things kind of came together, I think, when I was still in high school. But I never was really a huge fan of Casablanca, and I'm still not a huge fan of Casablanca.
Wow, okay.
It's a perfectly good movie as far as I'm concerned. I have nothing against it. There are other 40s films that I'm more interested in, but it's certainly a good example of the kind of coordination you were talking about, because even if it was written rapidly, and apparently there's some dispute about exactly how, you know, last minute some of these changes were, it does show that there was a sort of set of intuitions of craft practices that meant that even when you're doing something fast and under a strict deadline and sort of throwing everything together, the impulse to kind of smooth it all down, fit it all together, is so powerful in Hollywood that the various participants in the screenwriting, and of course the director as well, were able to make everything kind of gel. That's partly because I think the tradition of telling an integrated story was so firmly established, as I say, maybe just at a level of spontaneous intuition. Maybe nobody ever had to say, look, we have to plant certain things about Renaud's character in Act 1 so that he behaves a certain way in Act 3. Maybe nobody ever said that explicitly. But nevertheless, it's kind of there. I know that when looking through David O. Selznick's papers, I was struck by how self-conscious they were. There were records of meetings, of story meetings, story conferences. And the striking thing to me was how often Selznick, at least, and some of his collaborators would refer to kind of tacit rules and say things, look, we got to bring this back. Or don't forget the rule of three. You know, you mention something three times, it's important. So if this is important, we got to say it again. Those kinds of things, these little tips in the top, were probably at work in people's minds and maybe even in their discussions in the course of Casablanca, so that even if you're throwing a lot of stuff together, there's this very powerful impulse as these craft practitioners to make it all kind of gel. Now, of course, there are last-minute cases. In my book, I talk about cases where it didn't gel, where so many production confusions resulted in pretty discombobulated narratives, and that happens too, for sure. But when we do have a smoothly integrated one, I think we can say that it's a case where even if kind of alien material was dragged in, people found a way to integrate it.
Yeah, I'm honestly taken aback. You don't like Casablanca.
Oh, I don't dislike it. Yeah, I just don't have any special feeling for it. No, I don't have any special feeling. Because, well, I mean, it's fine. Maybe it's not weird enough for me. I don't know. Mm. It's possible. Or there's a sense... some of the films that I talk about in the book, I'm attracted to. Like, I find something like Daisy Kenyon a much more interesting film because it's got so many peculiarities of characterization and letting us in on what's happening in various scenes. There's just a kind of a darker and stranger side to so many 40s cinema, and not just to noirs, many other films, that when you have something just as nice and efficient and tidy as Casablanca, everything seems to be well contained. It's a perfectly good example. I don't want to say anything against it.
Sure.
I just don't feel the mystique in it that other people do.
Interesting. That's fascinating. I think you're probably one of the very first people I've ever heard say that, and I love that. yeah, I guess my reaction is generally always just wonder at how it all fits together. But I'm also I'm glad to hear that there's a holdout. There's someone for whom it just doesn't sparkle.
Partly it's I should say probably it's part because of the taste culture that I sort of grew into in my teens and early 20s of auteurism, because under the influence of Andrew Saras, there was a tremendous backlash against Michael Curtiz and against the official classics, so that films like Gone with the Wind or, you know, the liberal social problem films of the 40s, some of the films that exemplify the sort of political correctness, we might say, of the 1940s, and of Casablanca and Curtiz more generally, there was just a sense that, well, you know, these guys got credit when actually Hawks was ignored and Borzegui was ignored and Ulmer was ignored and so on. So there was a kind of redressing of, you know, what were felt to be unjust elevations. And in some sense, to say that Casablanca is the perfect Hollywood movie suggests for a Sarasite, yeah, it's the perfect non-auteur movie. Sure. There's no personality of the director in it. It's an efficient studio product. Now, I don't necessarily feel that's bad to be an efficient studio product. And for all I know, there's a lot of Michael Curtiz as an emigre in this movie. What I'm saying is that part of my reflexive, you know, non-enthusiasm, not very deep enthusiasm for Casablanca, probably comes from my commitment to an early and probably too hard-edged version of Saras's auteur theory.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about Michael Curtiz. I mean, this film is notoriously, or sort of the go-to example for the, as you say, non-auteurist theory. This is the Hollywood film that apparently directed itself, right? But Michael Curtiz did direct it, right? And I think, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think there is some renewed interest in Curtiz as a director. I know UCLA just did a retrospective, which they showed, I believe they showed Casablanca, Mildred Pierce. I know they showed Flamingo Road, which we'll get to Joan later. But in the intervening years since you first saw this, have you given it more, Mark Curtiz, more consideration as a director?
Well, I think Curtiz is an interesting director. I just think that the auteurs were looking for directors that had not just stylistic flair, but also something, if you like, deep to say, something, a thematic impulse, so that, for instance, Preminger is a very good technician of cinema, but Preminger has also got thoughts about human conduct, thoughts about complex organizations, thoughts about politics and so on, and those make their way in a consistent way into his films that you don't find in directors that just have visual flair. So, for instance, I would say Curtiz is a rather flashy director. You can see him as one of the people in the 30s, I think, who tries to bring the kind of polish, but also some of the tricksiness of the 20s silent cinema into 30s filmmaking, so that he can produce very polished studio entertainments, obviously Robin Hood, the Errol Flynn films, and so on. But he also has a turn towards a little bit flashy technique, so complicated camera movements, low angles, stark lighting, these kinds of things which are not unique to him, for sure, but they do have a slightly European tinge, maybe, or a little bit more of the silent cinema pictorialism that we find in some 30s pictures. And certainly he does hook up, and you mentioned Mildred Pierce, he hooks up with some very interesting projects. I mean, that's a film I'm much more fascinated by, I have to say, than Casablanca. Mm. And one way to think about Casablanca, I think, watching it again last night, I was thinking about this, it's kind of a post-Kane film. In that, it first of all makes extensive use of wide-angle cinematography. It's a very self-conscious use of wide-angle lenses throughout most of these conversation scenes in the film and in other places. It's also got a voiceover narrator that starts it off in a kind of quasi-newsreel fashion, a bit like Citizen Kane. And there's incorporated newsreel footage when the Germans advance on Paris. And it's got some of that sense of political dynamics that Wells, in fact, tried to bring into some of his projects that didn't get made. Films like The Smiler with a Knife, which he was going to make, was about homegrown American fascism. So there was a political side to Wells' work that shows up intermittently, certainly in Kane and in other works as well, that I think is sort of out there and now becomes available for people in the 40s, like people like Curtiz and other, the screenwriters for Casablanca. So I think, in a way, this is a film that's kind of, to some extent, dependent on some of the innovations that Greg Toland introduced in Citizen Kane or really built on from his prior work with Wyler and other directors, and some of the other aspects that make it kind of a typical 40s film. And, of course, the flashback. It isn't a terribly crucial flashback for some people. I know that Koch was of two minds about putting it in. It's a typical 40s thing because it's the juxtaposition of a situation that's very different from the present situation. So it serves an explanatory function, motivated as Rick's memory, but also coming at a crucial juncture in the film when he's just about to denounce her, Ilse, when she comes back to him. So there's a way in which it kind of typifies a lot of the trends I talk about in the book in the 40s. It's not as striking or bizarre an example as some of the other films I talk about, but it's there. It's part of the sort of general trend towards somewhat more complex storytelling and more complex characterization. Though in that sense, the war dynamic makes the characterization a little more pat, because if Rick and Renault, to some extent, are the two in-betweeners, the men who've chosen for the moment cynicism over idealism, there is a hint that both of them are going to change. It's very well crafted at the beginning of the film, that long 30-minute scene in Rick's cafe at the beginning of the film after the prologue sets up everything. It's really like a play in that respect. It sets up the first act is just setting up everything that's going to happen later. And that scene does plant all the seeds of how Rick will eventually stick his neck out for somebody and so on. So in that sense, I think the dramaturgy needed the flashback to kind of set off and show that he really is at heart a sentimentalist, as Renault says.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. Watching it this time, I was struck by how much the film sort of decentralizes the romance. What's foregrounded is kind of the environment, the milieu of Casablanca. We have the cafe, we have the airport, and there are only really a handful of scenes, a couple of scenes with Bergman and Bogey together, right? And so the flashback, while maybe not as interesting or maybe slightly more conventional, it does serve an important story function,
right?
right? It's sort of the kind of that's the where the kind of nostalgic tone comes from, right? The rest of it's pretty cynical.
Yeah, but also I think what's interesting, what you're pointing out, is something really interesting about how the film's constructed, because we begin away from the protagonists. She doesn't come in until 25 minutes into the film. And what we get is this kind of pinball bouncing and zigzagging among all these other characters. I mean, it's just, first of all, at the level of Hollywood production, it's this great collection of character actors. You know, everybody is in this movie, it seems. I expect Alan Jenkins to come walking in at any minute, you know. And the thing is, they have, the script sets up this kind of bouncing around of the different emigres that are there. The so much at the beginning in the outdoor scenes on the streets is dependent on what we might call adjacency or contiguity. So one person is next to another person. One person sees something else. One person's asked for his papers. He flees. And then when the plane comes in, we get a shot of Rick's Cafe. So with the plane flying overhead and the plane arriving with Strasser coming in on the at the airport and, you know, meeting him. So, I mean, there's this fantastic mosaic, really, of all these little pieces of things that are going to be important later set up in the exteriors. Then we go into the cafe, and they all converge, and we get this constant interplay of people looking for papers, trying to buy their way out of Casablanca, the zigzag introducing everybody, the Ferrari and Ugata, and all the characters are laid out for us. And that kind of busyness around the central characters, is, I think you're right, is it kind of displaces our interest from that romance. But then out of that busyness emerges the central issue and the romance of the couple and the creation and dissolution of the couple. So there's a way in which the film kind of pads out, you might say, with the political context, pads out that romance. But then that makes it more salient, because then the romance can take place as both against the backdrop of all the political intrigue, but also as a kind of culmination of the political intrigue, where the choice of politics has to be made over the romance.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I like the beginning starts sort of very broad, and then the story becomes more and more myopic as we go through. And then at the very end, obviously, we have the broadening out again, right? Extremely...
It's a very cunningly put together thing, and you have to admire it, that's for sure. And certainly Warner's having all these contract players there to liven all, what could have been kind of dead stuff if we didn't have Marcel Dalio or Peter Lorre and all these people that we kind of recognize to one degree or another. John Quaylen even shows up. You know, I mean, just it's just quite a remarkable array. So many Hollywood films of the 40s depend on that kind of ingratiation of just – look, these are familiar people. You've seen them before. You've heard them on the radio. You know what they look like. And you know the kind of parts they play. Let's just go with it. And that's something I think I miss now in modern cinema, where everyone is trying to impersonate a character who's very different from the person they played last time. You do have some set people, obviously, but still, nevertheless, some sort of, you know, stereotype characters, I suppose, that actors are turned to again and again. But nevertheless, Michael Shannon, I guess, would be an example of somebody who gets those kind of roles. But it just seems to me that that gives you so much when you have these known elements, how you can add little riffs and little changes. And like Cuddles, as Zakal, you know, the idea that he could actually be part of an underground organization. Mm-hmm. This is not part of this the package that he brings to the movie, but why not?
Right.
So, but at the same time, he's completely lovable. So there's a way in which this kind of stock company that the studios had can really nuance and vary a narrative to a great degree. And as I say, the first 30 minutes of the film really takes advantage of that.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, even the opening scene in Casablanca, the exterior scene where you have extras from Europe, presumably, right? They aren't doing impressions of Europeans. They are actual Europeans, mm-hmm. right? It really adds a lot of vibrancy and color to to the setting. But while we're on the subject of actors... I feel like, you know, this is the movie that made Humphrey Bogart a star, or at least that's how the legend goes. It's also the movie that made Ingrid Bergman a star. But do we want to challenge that notion at all? Like, is this the movie that really cemented Humphrey Bogart as an A-list actor?
I haven't done the research that could answer that question, but I would have a hunch that you'd have to start with at least The Maltese Falcon. Mm.
Yeah.
That trio of Greenstreet, Lorre, and Bogart, with Mary Astor, of course, added in. That really was commented on a great deal at the time. I think, and you know, Bogart really had earlier roles, but mostly straightforward villainous roles, or maybe complicated ones like in Petrified Forest. But High Sierra certainly is another one that people would point to, I think, as giving him prominence. I suppose it does, maybe it's the one that makes him a most plausible romantic lead. But again, I haven't done a sort of detailed research on that.
Sure, yeah, yeah. And then Bergman, quite a presence, right?
Right. For a while, most people felt she was the most beautiful woman in cinema. And it's interesting that Hedy Lamarr was considered for this role, too, because, again, she was considered to be like having the most perfect face in cinema. Again, she's, of course, fantastic. And one of the things that the film does, it's really kind of an unusual Warner's film in the glossiness of the technique. I think if you just took an isolated shots, you'd say, this is like an MGM movie. I mean, she's lit like Greer Garson, mm-hmm. and her eyes glisten mm-hmm. all the time. There's sparkle in almost every shot of her. There's really getting a heavy dose of the glamour treatment. So that's certainly enhancing her performance. The big thing about her is that she can seem very unspoiled. She's a glamorous woman who doesn't seem to be highbrow. She seems to be the kind of woman who could just slip into slacks and run across a field. And that way, I think it certainly does help her performance in this film. And her line readings are fantastic, and she doesn't blink. She's one of the great non-blinkers. Ah, she just doesn't blink.
Good to know, right?
You know? Well, it's hard, you know, under all those lights. One of the most fascinating things is how do you control your blinking? And she just doesn't blink.
Sure,
it's really
cool.
She's like Judy Garland in that respect. These ladies just somehow manage never to blink. And so there's a tremendous intensity when you see characters looking at each other unblinkingly, even if it's not threatening or menacing. That's a really important technique that actors have. They have tricks. I mean, Bogart lowers his eyes and he blinks when he ends a line or something, but she is really like hypnotized. It's really something.
Yeah. In the audio commentary on the DVD that I have, Roger Ebert comments that she's one of the best actresses at looking down.
Hmm.
And maybe that averting her gaze
downcast
is just a way
eyes.
To like...
Maybe it's a way to steal a blink.
Exactly.
Yeah. Could be.
Maybe.
Could be.
Yeah. But, and then... He also mentioned that some people think that Claude Rains has the most difficult role in the film because his job is to react rather than drive the action, right? And I feel like we could just make this the Claude Rains Appreciation Hour because I think he's just
superb in everything. The guy's never let us down.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because I do believe he had a bit of a sense of that he was the guy who could steal a movie. If you put him if you're in a scene with him, you watch out because he can really take the scene away from you. And it's fascinating to look at those scenes with him and Bogart together because he's short, but his line readings, this is again a forehead movie. I mean, you've got many Farber writes about how Peter Lorre likes to wrinkle his forehead, but everybody's doing it in this movie. There's this constant thing, and Rains is really good at lifting and lowering his eyebrows and his hairline. So there's a sense in which it's kind of the battle of the forebrains. But there's still he's a great actor. He really is. And another example of this classic of the repertory of contract players that Warner's had it could call on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then there's good old Paul Henreid.
Right, who always gets the short end of the stick
because
it's hard to play noble, and he's noble. But that sympathetic moment he has at the end where he's just saying, don't have to tell me anything, is fine. I mean, no, he's exactly what he should be in that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe it's a little bit unfair, and maybe with time we'll start to revisit that character mm-hmm. and maybe start to see his appeal a mm-hmm. little bit more. He's certainly very handsome.
He's very handsome. He's got a scar. Shows he suffered in prison in the concentration camps. But I think there's a general sense that, you know, whenever you have a triangle, there's usually a weak third side, third point, you know. And he's kind of it. Although, again, to go back to Daisy Kenyon, there's no weak point in that triangle.
That's very true.
But anyway, there's, you know, he's completely adequate to the role, it seems to me. But it's hard to be suffering nobility, and he manages it.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess we sort of talked about how the film sort of decentralizes the romance, but at the same time, that's primarily what people remember from
mm-hmm.
the film.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if the way that eventually the film comes together into this sort of dramatic, nostalgic romance sort of allows audiences or gives audiences permission to kind of forget or cast aside the other parts of the movie, which in some ways are more thematically complex.
It's possible. I mean, it's interesting to think about what people remember from movies, but part of that's so much reinforced by popular culture mm-hmm. and what, you know, the image of the two of them, you know, looking at each other on the airport tarmac. I guess I think that the film really does treat the political stuff as a background to the romance, even though at the time, of course, the political context was extremely salient for contemporary audiences. But I guess I think that maybe what's in balance in the film gets a little lopsided for the reason you say, because the charisma of the stars and the various qualities of the narrative building towards this ultimate self-sacrifice. I also think that the politics, you know, have been reduced to a pretty simple thing, like these magical letters of transit.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
Just they get you anywhere. Anyone right. can have them. Anyone can sign for them. It's sure. just a pretty amazing device to
yeah.
have in a narrative. You know, get out of jail free card.
Yeah.
So that kind of thing, in a way, focuses the politics so intently on an intrigue, on a spy kind of device, a MacGuffin, if you like.
Sure. Yeah. I think Hitchcock would approve. yeah. So we kind of talked about how this film passed through several different hands, writers' hands. But do you get any sense of the sort of any sense of disjointedness, or how, if not, how did this all manage to come together so smoothly?
Well, as you said, it really is, I think, a well-integrated film. I haven't done any detailed research. We could between the USC papers and our papers here, because we have the play, drafts of the play and some of the scripts and so on here in our collection. But I haven't really, again, I guess it speaks to my lack of fundamental passion for the film, researched it. But it's so common to have multiple authorship in Hollywood with so many screenwriters. I remember Anita Luce said, I really like working for Hollywood. It's like laying tile. Everybody gets a certain section to just lay down, you know, and it's very straightforward. And several screenwriters said, and I quote some of them in the book, where they say, actually, it's better if you aren't the sole author of a screenplay, because first of all, you don't have the same, you know, dedication to it. You don't feel as protective of it. You know, you can treat it in a more objective fashion. But secondly, you can see things in other people's work that can be adjusted or changed. In other words, in a way, so much of Hollywood screenwriting is revision. You're taking an existing property, say, a story or a novel or a play or whatever, and you're reworking it. And as you know, as most people know, it's kind of easier to do that mm-hmm. than it is to come up with something fresh on your own.
Yeah.
And then if you've got an original script, if it's handed off to somebody else, they tweak it and play with it. And of course, everybody on the line will say, oh gosh, you changed something I really liked and you shouldn't have done it. This was a terrible decision and so on. But nevertheless, what can come out of it can be fairly coherent and interesting in its own right. It's just that we aren't usually used to thinking about the creative dimensions of collective authorship, collective creation. But it's very common in the history of the arts. It's not just Hollywood. It's called an assembly line. It's clearly not an assembly line because every work is unique. But if you think of classic painters' ateliers, a painter like Rembrandt or others would have a staff, and they would paint certain parts of a picture, and the master would come in and paint the eyes or the lips or whatever, but everybody else was doing background work and so on. And even though it's signed by Rembrandt or Bruegel or whatever, it's a group effort. And this is not so different from Hollywood, actually, where the people have to follow certain guidelines, but there is still room for individual creativity and maybe on very small scale. So I think that once these things are out there in process, once the film is undergoing these kind of revisions, everybody has a sort of tacit sense of how to make the movie. Maybe not they don't all go in the same direction, but they kind of have a standard for what a Hollywood movie is. And they use those intuitions and pieces of craft knowledge to shape it. And someone will go, oh, yeah, I see that. That would work. But then if you do that, you have to go back and do this. Oh, yeah, I have to do that. Okay, we'll do that. And so on. This kind of mutual readjustment can result in something pretty smooth.
Yeah. I mean, in some sense, this movie is pretty cynical and dark. But there's at the center of it, again, is this sort of wistfulness, this cheesiness almost. It's almost corny, right? So you have to have someone, like whoever is writing this, all the collaborators need to be kind of on the same page, and maybe one person can be the more sentimental
yes.
writer, the other can be the
yes.
more cynical, and then in some way, some magical way, you find balance, right?
But it isn't really magical, I think. There is a kind of rationality to it, because let me take just one convention, which is going back to where you were. I mean, how do you motivate character change? This is a classic problem of drama. If you're going to have a drama of character change, which a lot of dramas are, but not all. Not all narratives are about character change. But if you're going to have a story of character change, you have to justify it somehow. Okay, but then certain ideas about what character is, what can make somebody change, all those things come into play. And one of the commonest strategies in Hollywood is to say, well, somebody was once this way, and then they became that way. But now, under the pressure of circumstances, they go back to the way they were. Take Jerry Maguire, for instance. Jerry Maguire is a shark in a suit at the beginning of the film. But we know from his prologue that he admires, A, kids, and B, good, skillful athletes. Those are there. And that's why he writes his mission statement, because he thinks that the whole business of agency representation has gotten away from that. Now, he is a shark in a suit. He just can't. He's not as good at it as the other sharks. But he comes around again to being the person he was before. And this is what character changes so often in Hollywood. People discovering what they were before, but they've strayed from the path. And that's Bogart's story. He fought for Spain. He helped get arms to Ethiopia. But he got cynical. And it's partly because of Ilsa. He got cynical. Mm-hmm. He was betrayed. And so he became bitter, hardened, sour, and so on, the Rick that we see at the beginning. But he has a chance to go back to the way he was. Now, I would surmise that everybody in the Hollywood system understands that convention. And it's interestingly, it's tied to star images. Because when you see a star, usually they have played roles of the way they were. Mm-hmm. Even if they misbehave in this film, we can expect Gary Cooper to become Gary Cooper again in the course of the narrative, mm-hmm. or whoever. Sure. So here I think the collaborators tacitly may have understood Bogey's going to change into someone idealistic, you know. George Raft was considered for the role, whatever. But the point is, they've got to become the good bad man, the guy who changes because under the pressure of circumstances and finds the good side of himself, which was kind of always there.
Yeah.
If everybody's on board with that tacitly, then it's really just body and fender work. Then really all you're doing is figuring out how do we plot it.
Yeah, yeah, that's an interesting way to think about it because, well, Bogey, you know he's gonna turn, right? Ultimately, he is a good guy. We know this. Claude Rains, maybe not so much, right? There were a number of different roles in his career where it could have gone either way, right?
Right. No, that's true. The star image isn't as firm there. That's right. But I would say that first of all, he's set up as even more cynical than Rick.
Mm.
And that makes him an opportunist. That means he's going to seize on certain things. But also, he's a Frenchman, too. That's key.
Right.
And that when he throws away the bottle of Vichy water, that's a sign that, you know, he really is ultimately a Frenchman. And he's also, what's with him, it's not what he does, it's what he doesn't do. He isn't as strenuous in doing the things that a real Vichyite would have done. He doesn't, for instance, when the Marseillaise is sung. He really needs Strasser to prod him to close the club. He's an opportunist. He's passive. He's got a good birth, essentially, seducing women who need passports, that
right.
sort of thing.
Right.
So he's more passive and more reactive. And that's a situation you can see someone flipping into. And there's enough. Plus, he has a good sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who has a good sense of humor has got a plus in a Hollywood movie.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
So I think, you know, they're both men in between. Rick's is the dramatic version. In a way, the Renault becomes the sidekick. Renault becomes the guy who goes along.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Before we leave the subject of the screenplay, I feel like I have to ask you about all the famous lines. And I think that's partially what makes this movie so memorable.
Absolutely.
You know, take your pick. Basically, every single line of this movie is famous. One, do you have a personal favorite?
Again, you know, I'm not a cultist for this movie,
okay.
So I like them all. Every time they come up, I certainly like them. I mean, what I noticed this time was that it's interesting that the first time Strasser says, round up twice the usual number of suspects.
Right, yeah.
And this is, to me, the genius of the system. The second time it comes back is round up the usual suspects.
Right, right.
So before it's like, just bring me the 20, bring me 20 suspects, whatever, just whatever the standard number is. The second time is go for the particular ones. Those little tweaks to me show really good craft. And so now I think my favorite line is round up twice the usual number of suspects. I want to make that one as famous as the later one.
I think we can make that happen. I guess while we're on the subject of like rewatching, do you find yourself noticing new things each time you watch it?
But that's true of every movie.
Every movie, yeah.
Yes, of course. I noticed new things this time. I was particularly impressed this time by certain shots, particularly the way Curtiz used deep focus and even shallow focus at some points to throw Ingrid Bergman out of focus at times. It was interesting. Mm-hmm. But every movie you find more.
I guess that's true, yeah. I guess this viewing, because the Cinematheque showed Five Graves to Cairo recently here at Madison, I noticed the joke about the Italian a lot more.
Was this a common thread
in classic Hollywood films? We would just beat up on the Italians.
Well, I think also during the war, they're seen clearly as the weak sister in the group.
Sure.
You know, they're serious in some ways, but kind of comic operas. They're not as really sinister as the Germans or the Japanese.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, partly, of course, there are lots of Italian Americans too. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are a lot of German Americans as well, but they're, you know, clearly. The Italians, if you're going to have comic have variety with some comic bits on the side, then the Italians are a good target.
Sure. Yeah. I love that. I love that as a motif in the film.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have a very silly question for you.
Mm-hmm.
This is the 84th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll. Do you think it is worthy of that spot? Obviously, that's a pretty arbitrary number, and it's a pretty silly question, but I'm wondering, more broadly, do you think this movie will continue to resonate with contemporary audiences? Do you think it still stands the test of time?
Do you think it's over the years of the poll, do you think it's gone down in people's estimation?
I mean,
is 84 the
I don't know
a
what
low
it was
point
the
low. For it?
I'm not sure, I'd have to look. I'm guessing that seems very low to me.
It's kind of surprisingly low,
isn't
it?
Yeah.
I don't know. I've been asked to participate in those and other polls, the Sight and Sound polls and the Film Comment poll and so on. I never do because I just don't see much point in it, really. Mm. I mean, it can be – the only use of it is to call people's attention to films that you feel are neglected.
Sure.
But as long as Vertigo or Citizen Kane is at the top of the list, I really can't get too worried.
You know,
people are neglecting, you know, these films. I don't know. Is there 83 better movies in the world? Probably.
Probably.
Yeah, I would guess so.
Yeah.
But I can't really say.
Yeah. I don't know. It's an odd choice for a movie that is so popular, right?
Well, the real test might be looking at IMDb or some of those other places.
Right, yeah.
But that's so fickle because IMDb doesn't seem to have any control. And people, I remember looking at that once and seeing that, of course, Shawshank Redemption was one or two or something like that. But then the latest Christopher Nolan Batman movie was number one, you know.
Of course,
so I think,
yeah.
What does this mean?
Is it
just, you know, people revoting and revoting? I don't know.
Right.
It's just these things. I mean, in a way, they're important and yet completely unimportant at the same time. They're important because they do affect people's tastes. People do use so-called crowdsourcing or whatever. And obviously, Rotten Tomatoes has gotten tremendous power now as an aggregator of critics. But individual critics seem to have lost their power to some degree. Mm. But who would judge what they like in a movie by what other people thought?
Right.
In a way, that was my problem with Saras, was that because Saras was not only trying to produce an aesthetic history of American cinema, which is a very laudable goal, and thinking about what are the accomplishments of American cinema, what are its traditions, how do directors negotiate issues of genre and negotiate issues of theme and so forth. These are really important issues. But he, like many, said, look, we only got so much time on our hands, let's just focus on the best. And that meant looking past the great body of often anonymous work that is creating the tradition that good or great directors emerge out of. And that, of course, seems very important to me as well, to look at the unknown films and inconsequential films even. So the question becomes how much you're going to let taste decide what you do. As a person, of course, it really matters because you've got only a limited amount of time. But as a researcher, I think you can't always be driven by your taste. You can't always just watch the movies you like
Sure.
and avoid the movies you don't like.
Sure, yeah. But as far as what movies should we show to introduce people to the classic Hollywood cinema?
Everybody's got their own little canon, and mine has always been films like Meet Me in St. Louis,
sure.
His Girl Friday.
Yeah.
I think His Girl Friday is a much better film than Casablanca.
Okay,
If I'm forced to say that, I think Hawks is a better director than Curtiz. I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can go there,
sure.
If we're talking about evaluation. But just in terms of salient features of classical construction, I think Casablanca could be a perfectly good example to use if people can dig into it. Sure, why not? I think with His Girl Friday, you have a nice blend of a film that's really conventionally constructed, but also has incredibly individual, kind of a unique identity in the way it handles those conventions. Casablanca uses the conventions very effectively, whereas I would say, speaking just this from my preferences, that His Girl Friday not only uses the conventions, but actually gives them a certain resonance and force, and even just like the level of your body, you know, that I don't feel when I watch Casablanca. But sure, anything will go. I mean, when we did our book on the classical Hollywood cinema, we used not exactly a random sample, but what we called an unbiased sample of just going through lists of films and arbitrarily by number picking out some films and seeing what we could learn from them. I mean, to go general on this, I think there's a difference. The ordinary viewer doesn't care. They just want pleasure and enjoyment, feel emotions. But I think that not enough critics, and by this I mean mostly reviewers, are really curious about what a film teaches them about cinema. They have their own canon. They have their own criteria. They say this is good, this is bad, this is stupid, this is nice. And there isn't usually enough time in a space of a short review to really dig into a movie. But when you think when a critic of the visual arts goes to a museum, they try to show people how to appreciate what the film, what the painter or the sculptor is trying to do. They try to say, look, this may seem weird, but actually what they're trying to do is this, that, and the other. They fit into a certain tradition, or they're part of a movement, or they have their own personal issue about they want to explore this aspect or that aspect of painting. And I don't feel that as much with popular reviewers of film. That they tend to think, I'm the judge, and I'm going to let the films march past me, and I'm going to bang the gavel on the bad ones. I just think that, I guess critics aren't, I think, curious enough about the possibilities of cinema and say, look, let's think about what this film, even a very conventional film, can illuminate in terms of the possibilities of cinema. So that even a film, a typical genre film, like, say, the Paranormal Activity series, mm-hmm. or films which are really, it's not just about giving us a scare or whatever, but they're poking around inside the possibilities of cinema. And critics, I think, should be sensitive to that, too, as well as making recommendations about what to see this weekend. So when I would teach about classical Hollywood cinema, I would say, you know, on the one hand, what canons and conventions of what formulas, if you like, of classical style and story are being exploited here. But also, is there something going on here that suggests more? There's something that cinema could do that maybe wasn't so common. And that's really what the book is about, is a book looking at the 1940s. By 1939, Hollywood had figured out how to make a Hollywood movie. That seems very clear. The question is, how can we go beyond that? And not all filmmakers, but many filmmakers said, can we push farther? Can we find other things to do with cinema than we've done, you know, up till now? So to me, that's something that critics could be doing as well. Be asking, okay, when these things are happening, are the horizons or frontiers of filmmaking being stretched or enlarged or poked at? That would be worth doing, I think.
Okay, now that we've talked about the quintessential movie of the 1940s, we're going to branch out a little bit to discuss narrative strategies of the era more generally. The standard historical account of 1940s Hollywood film style suggests that it was a time of considerable creative output, but not necessarily growth or formal development. The teens through the 1930s saw major industry innovations, including the mastering of bubble framing, continuity editing, and eventually dialogue and sound design. By contrast, the 1940s are the period in which these previously perfected techniques flourished, but the decade itself didn't produce any industry advances, at least nothing on par with the previous decades. However, in David's latest book, Reinventing Hollywood, he argues that the 1940s Hollywood filmmakers didn't merely piggyback on techniques of the past, but rather built and innovated using new narrative ideas and structures. For our next segment, we'll step through some of the story strategies which are delineated in the book. And since David saw fit to have one Joan Crawford grace the cover of the book, we have the perfect excuse to just yammer on about the greatness of Joni and her 1940s output. But let's talk more generally first before we get to Joan. David, tell me about the genesis of this project. How did you decide to write a book about the 1940s?
Well, I'd always been interested in films of the 1940s, and I'd used them a lot as examples in other work. A couple things popped up for me when I was working on other projects, when I was working with Kristen Thompson and Janet Steiger on the Classical Hollywood Cinema book. It seemed like a lot of my examples were gravitating towards the 40s. Some of the key instances I used just to illustrate ideas were best shown by films from the 40s. And then I was teaching the 40s quite a lot, as we talked about, films from the 40s, partly because I was here at Wisconsin, which had a good collection of RKO and Warner's pictures from the 30s and 40s, so I could show The Locket, I could show Possessed, I could show lots of different films from that period. And I loved Hollywood cinema, the 30s and 40s on television, which I got to see when TV was just starting to show packages of studio pictures released to TV. But actually what made it salient for me was working on another book, a book on contemporary Hollywood, when I began to realize a lot of the cool innovations that we associate with Tarantino and Steven Soderbergh and other directors of the 90s and 2000s really seemed to have their roots in what Hollywood was doing in the period of the 40s. So that sort of set off a flag in my head thinking, well, maybe I should look at that. Something I do on some summers is give summer courses in Belgium, and one year we had to pick a topic, and so I picked, let's look at Hollywood in the 40s. And as I prepared films, watching a lot of films for that, and then figuring out what to show and developing lectures, I began to realize that there was quite a bit to be said about this that I didn't see said in a systematic way before. To take a quick example, everybody talks about how film noir uses certain things like flashbacks, voiceover, subjective states like dreams, hallucinations, all that stuff. It's all very true. But because people are so fixated on film noir, they really, I think, overlook the fact that these expressive techniques are really in all genres practically, probably least in Westerns. But nevertheless, they pervade Hollywood output from the late 30s on, and noir makes particular use of them for sure. But also comedies use them, and family sagas use them, and straight-up dramas use them, and so on. So I began to realize that instead of doing a kind of survey of genres, which is one common way people talk about the 40s, or of directors or producers, which is other possibilities, I thought, what if I looked at terms of a kind of menu of creative options? What if I thought, if you're starting out as a director or a screenwriter in the 40s, what are the kind of choices that are out there as instantiated in films, but also maybe in terms of popular culture generally? There are in plays or there are novels or on radio, some other narrative strategies that are out there circulating in the culture that can be brought into film, maybe transformed a bit in doing so. So I began to think I could organize my inquiry around narrative techniques, really, rather than genres or stars or whatever. So that's the way it crystallized for my lectures in this Belgian summer school. And I began to think, well, why couldn't we do this on a larger scale? So it meant watching hundreds of films, which I proceeded to do, and eventually began a kind of attempt to think of Hollywood as a creative ecosystem where all these things are out there. They're flourishing and growing in different directions, and there are little spaces left to try for another organism to get in and do something. I use two or three different kinds of analogies. The ecosystem is one. Another is the menu. I mean, if you think of it as a static sort of table or chart, here's what you can do. For instance, you're going to have a flashback. Okay, you want to have flashback. You start the film at a point of crisis and then flashback to how you got there. Well, that's one option. Or do you start the film in a placid way and eventually bring a flashback in to explain things, which happens in Casablanca? Or do you maybe use several flashbacks? Do you build your whole movie around flashbacks so that the connective tissue in the present is pretty thin compared to what we get in the past? All these options, they're not just free choices, they're forced choices, because once you make a film with flashbacks, you only have a certain set of choices, at least given the givens of what you're going to be, the tradition you're working in. So there's a set of options, a constrained set of options, and what you can then do is say, okay, let's look at how films use them. And do they tweak them? Do they just run through them again, or do they play something differently? So that was the effort, was to look at the themes and variations, you might say, the menu items or the ecosystems, organisms, and see exactly how they work. So then you get to cases where you have films that just run the rules. They run these things. By the end of the 40s, for instance, flashbacks are, in a way they would never have been in the early 40s, they're out of order, they're brief, they're fragmentary, and people are starting to even complain about them. Screenwriters are putting in these complicated flashback structures, and either producers or even exhibitors, when they get the final film, are saying, this is too hard. Audiences don't understand it.
Mm.
That's interesting to me.
Yeah.
Even if they've gone too far, the fact that these narrative strategies got picked up, pushed hard, developed, it's kind of interesting, isn't
yeah.
it? I mean, it certainly speaks against the vaunted, you know, staleness of Hollywood, even
sure.
the 40s or any era, but also the idea that there's a kind of arms race among these people about a competition that says, look, if you did this, maybe I can take a jump ahead of that.
Right.
So to me, this is all fascinating. So the question became, well, what could enable this? What could allow this to happen? And I looked into the conditions of the industry, the state of the filmmaking community at the time, and I tried to make a case that this was a moment when it was really possible to try to stretch the boundaries, and that there were various economic, institutional, culture of the community kinds of reasons. So that was the effort that the book finally eventuated in, what kind of map, if you like, to take another metaphor, of the various storytelling traditions that emerge in the 40s. And then to say, okay, what happened after? And I sketch very briefly at the end the possibility that filmmakers afterwards, 50s and 60s certainly, but by the 90s, you've got people who've grown up on video and have seen a lot of classic films. Someone like Christopher Nolan is a perfect example of this. He's a guy who has seen a lot of 40s cinema, and he clearly has taken a lot of inspiration from the kinds of narrative innovations. And often they try to go farther.
Sure.
So this is a living tradition. It isn't just enclosed by the period I studied.
Sure, yeah. Let's determine what exactly we're talking about when we say 1940 cinema. So intuitively we think 1940 to 1949, right? But you kind of step through films from the early 30s, and then there's films
right.
from 1950s, and
right.
then...
I think there's a crystallization. That's my argument. It's a coalescence or crystallization from around 1939 to 52, though it's a very soft boundary at that end. I think it's quite soft. But from 39 to 52, you get a kind of concentrated coalescence of these possibilities. What we do find before in the silent era and in the 30s are one-offs, instances, outliers, people who are trying to do some of these things. Like, they're complicated. Now and again, there's a complicated flashback film in the 30s. Not very commonly, once in a while, often a B film. But then by the time you get to the 40s, there's a prestige attached exactly to these innovations, to using voiceover, using flashbacks, using psychoanalytic and psychiatric kinds of motifs, those kinds of things. As a prestige attached, and people are jumping on the bandwagon. By 52, it's kind of played out to some degree, I think, although you still find them, of course, afterwards, find one-off instances. But then I think the industry turns to other things. Pauline, you mentioned something I think is really important, that people tend to think of innovation in Hollywood in terms of technology. So when do we get sound? When do we get color? When do we get widescreen? When do we get stereo in theaters? Those kinds of things. Well, if that's your map, then the 40s are kind of a valley. You know, they seem to be a period of stabilization of all that stuff that was happening with sound in the 30s up to 39 or so, and then waiting for widescreen and the biblical spectacle and so on. But actually, if you look at it in terms of not technology, but in terms of technique, in terms of narrative techniques, I think you find a really rich load of innovations in that period of the 40s. So I bracketed it 39 to 52. Those are arguable, but I needed something manageable. So my 40s are a little bit long,
yeah.
But we don't expect that the film history or any history will match the calendar perfectly.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the the influences that might be impacting screenwriters or directors in their constructing these narratives, right? So you talk a lot about modernist literature and how that might have been a major influence on these sort of schemas that you outline in the book.
Yeah. The spin I put on that is that by the 1930s, the late 30s, modernism is really established as a kind of set thing. It's really, if you think of modernism in literature, that is to say novels, poems, and plays, you really have it peaking, high modernism, in the 20s, and particularly around 1922. That's the year of The Wasteland. That's the year of Ulysses. It's the year of Pirandello's Six Characters of a Search and an Author. This is sort of like modernism at its peak, I would say, for common understanding. And then it's you still have modernist writing, of course, in the 20s and indeed the 30s. Faulkner would be taken as an exemplary modernist writer, or Henry Green in England and so on. There are still modernism going on. But what happens, I think, and this is maybe one of the more original aspects of the book, is that those innovations of modernism get picked up very quickly by people in much more commercial venues, novelists who write for bigger audiences, and playwrights who aim at Broadway, so that these kinds of modernist developments get mainstreamed. And they're mainstreamed in other media. They're also mainstreamed in film to some degree, but the other media was what attracted me, because you think of, say, what Dwight MacDonald called mid-cult, which is the idea of taking modernism but making it easier, making it compatible with middlebrow culture. And so he would pick on something like Our Town as an example. Well, at one level, it's a very radical play. There's no settings. People address the audience, or members of the audience are part of the play. They call out from the audience and things like that. That seems really, you know, something out of the 20s experimental theater. But actually, it's not. Actually, it's got this homespun, folksy quality to it. It's very easy modernism, if it's that. And Dwight MacDonald, of course, objected to this. I find this fascinating because I think it's happening all over, that that commercial writers are picking up on all these devices that were in modernism and shaving and shaping them to fit something that's more easily digestible. And I think this is going on right in the 20s and 30s, that they're picking it up very, very fast. So multiple novels with multiple narrators and false resolutions, unreliable narrators, and so on, we're starting to see those in popular fiction in the 20s and 30s. In a way, the hard-boiled school, someone like Hammett comes out of some of this, too. He's not just vulgarized Hemingway. I think he's really playing with some of this. So what happens, I think, is that film, being as film is the most expensive art, is going to be late to experiment. I mean, it's easy to write an experimental novel. It's hard to make an experimental film. But eventually, ambitious writers in Hollywood decide that some of this stuff they can assimilate. One of my favorite examples is a novel from the 40s called A Letter to Five Wives. Mm. This novel came out just like any other book, but it had already been serialized in a popular magazine. It comes out, and it's kind of an interesting experiment because it's basically this letter that says this woman has run off with one of these five women's husbands, and the question is which one. And each one has to think back on their past over things that might have made her husband run off with this floozy. Well, it's all given in this very fragmentary way. We jump back and forth in different characters' minds as they think back and forth about, and we're all over the place. This is kind of a very experimental novel, but it's completely understandable. There's no problem. It's all set up so that you can completely follow it. So it comes to the movies, and you get Letter to Three Wives. All right, they lose two wives and so on. Yeah. But the upshot is it's kind of an experimental film, too, at that level, you know, because you're asked to judge. It's about class mobility. You're asked to judge these three women and how they've had to make a success in their lives in various different circumstances and whether these men can be trusted. I mean, it's a very interesting movie, and the construction of it is enveloped by a voiceover, which is not in the book, of the woman who's run off with him, and she narrates the film. She's, in fact, watching the film along with us and commenting on what's going on. Well, this is pretty unthinkable in the 1930s.
Yeah.
It's a modernist kind of film, a modernist inflected film, I should say, that's come through the conduit of popular media. And I think this is true with so many things. Orson Welles is an exemplary instance of this. Hitchcock, I think, is an example of this. Mm. They're taking stuff that was hard and challenging in high modernism, but has been filtered through the mass media and softened and made more digestible, and then giving an extra burst of energy by putting it into cinema. And in the context of 40 cinema, it really is more, in a way, innovative and original than the literary works would have been in their context.
Sure, yeah. So Letter to Three Wives is Mankiewicz, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so speaking of Mankiewicz.
Let me just add, that's a good example of your influence thing, because, of course, he's college educated. He's he's got a very scholarly turn of mind, and other filmmakers, writers and directors who come in then are kind of intellectuals, and they pick up on this stuff.
I think Mankiewicz gets short shrift a lot of the time, and I love that the book focuses a good deal on his work, specifically All About Eve, which you mentioned is a good example of like this polyphonic narration, right? So I was wondering maybe you can go into a little bit more detail about that and how All About Eve is structured and why that is a really good example of a sort of modernist, fractured way of telling a story.
Yeah, it is a good example. No, I'm an admirer of All About Eve, too. I'd much rather watch it than Casablanca.
Me, too.
But the thing that's interesting there is, I mean, he definitely played with narration. That was one of the things that got him. As a literary person, he thought about that, and he loved the idea that multiple points of view. So he does it in Letter to Three Wives. And again, I should credit Vera Caspary, who was the major screenwriter that turned that novel into a film, because she really has a great gift for structure for herself, if you know Laura or Bedelia or some of her other books. But anyway, so there the narrative issue is three characters remembering their past in a much more unified way than they are in the novel. That's more fragmentary. Remembering their past under the overarching single narrator that is Addie Ross, the woman who supposedly ran off with one of them husbands. With All About Eve, what you've got is a kind of pass the ball along, where you've got Addison DeWitt kind of serving as the master of ceremonies in the narration, but then his own mind sort of drifts away, and we get other characters, Karen and the Betty Davis character, narrating the action too. And then Addison comes back and the whole thing closes, but then we see Eve by herself, unnarrated. I mean, this is a very complicated layout. Mm-hmm. And in fact, Mankiewicz wanted to have two of his narratives, two of the embedded stories in these flashbacks, to replay the same action. And Darrell F. Zenick wouldn't permit it. It was just wasteful, he thought. But Mankiewicz then began to think, if you have a replay, what can that entail? Well, there were replays in Hollywood films before, and in the not just in the 40s, in the 30s. But replays were usually used to show a missing fact. Mm. That is, in a trial situation, like the witness chair, where somebody testifies something, we flash back to it, somebody else testifies, and eventually we get a flashback that fills in little bits of information we didn't get in the first flashback. But it's the same event being recounted. What I think Mankiewicz was interested in is, what if we could do that with character? What if we could have a flashback that then got replayed from another character's point of view that didn't reveal new facts, but actually gave a different tint to the scene, a different coloration to the scene, because we're seeing it through a different character's eyes? Now, this is common in literary narrative, of course, because you can write things a certain way that suggests a character's attitudes. Much harder in film, because you're just shooting these images. But he was trying for it, and he couldn't get it in All About Eve. He did get it in Barefoot Contessa. Mm. He did get it to replay the scene, and I think most critics feel it didn't succeed terribly well, but he gets a replay that is really seen through another perspective, a different character's perspective. So that kind of thing fascinated him, a technical problem that fascinated him. And this is, again, something that comes up in the 40s, where directors become fascinated by technical problems. Sometimes they are stylistic problems, like you mentioned, camera mobility. So how do we handle a crane? How do we handle certain kinds of rotating camera tracking devices? How long can we extend a take? There was a real competition, I think, among 40s directors to make long takes. All those kinds of things. But at the same level, I think there was a challenge at the level of narrative, too. Like, they would set themselves certain narrative problems. And again, this resonates now, because clearly someone like Tarantino or Christopher Nolan or others are saying, I'm just interested in certain ways of telling stories. And what can I do to push those ways? So I guess I think that sort of technical turn of mind was something you didn't find quite so much in the 30s, and it became more salient in the 40s, and it would attract people, intellectuals, self-conscious intellectuals like Mankiewicz.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Preston Sturges.
Yeah. So, speaking of replay structures, I think now's probably a good time to mention Mildred Pierce, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's kind of the quintessential. Right?
Perfect example, yeah, exactly. And the fascinating thing there is, you asked earlier about what do we remember from a film? Like, do we remember Rick and Ilse's romance more than we remember the political context? There's a film, Mildred Pierce, that's depending on your forgetting something, depending on how Monty dies. Is two different versions of Monty's death, but they're an hour and a half apart. Mm-hmm. So you can't really be sure, was that really the way it happened? But that is a very cunning construction in Mildred Pierce. The flashback, we start with a murder, and we think we see all of it, but we don't. So we get a replay that fills in the facts, the classic kind of, but it fills them in a different differential way, because what we saw in the beginning is not respected by what happened later. It's a different different version of minor, small-scale events, the way Monty rolls his head. In the first one, he seems to be accusing Mildred. In the second, he seems to be remembering Mildred. Mm. And so that kind, but then when you see that, people couldn't go back and watch movies unless
sure,
they just went back and bought another ticket, you
sure,
know.
Yeah.
So they can't rewind it, you know.
Yeah.
So people go, oh, yeah, it must have been the way it was.
Right.
So the movie actually plays on the fallibility of human memory, I think.
Sure.
But also, of course, it's just brilliantly constructed in the way in which the ellipses of the first one are hidden. The way it's concealed, how much time has passed. For instance, Veda and Mildred are there, yeah. and they talk to each other for a while. Yeah. That's not shown to us, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, no, it's a perfect example of the way of people experimenting in the 40s. Now, is it fair? Does it play fair with the audience? Probably not, but who cares? But, I mean, it's really about the experience and the misleading of the audience. But you get it in a lot of films. You get it in The Unsuspected. You get it in various films that are usually given a mystery or crime slant. But not always. I mean, The Affairs of Susan, which is a film I talk a bit about too, or Lydia. You can do these things, you can play these narrative tricks with romantic dramas too, where there's no crime involved at all. So I find that's what I go back to is the fact that those strategies, the exploration of that ecological multitude, really pervades almost every genre.
Sure, yeah. I'm getting back to Joan just because... just because, you know, I love her. But you talk a lot about Grand Hotel and the sort of how that provided kind of a template for other movies in the 1940s, right? Obviously, Grand Hotel's 1930s movie. Just the idea that you can have multiple protagonists and they can all come together and it can all kind of fit together to tell one cohesive story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How did that eventually manifest itself in 1940s cinema? Is that just a kind of a trend or... was that a persistent narrative device used throughout the decade?
It isn't as common in the 40s as it was in the 30s. Mm-hmm. What happens, I think, again, it's a perfect example of the sort of mainstreaming of modernism. If you take Virginia Woolf's book, Mrs. Dalloway, which is a multiple character narrative, I mean, there really are multiple protagonists in a single slice of time in one day. That's kind of a model for this. And what Vicky Baum does in Germany with Grand Hotel... her novel and play, is to turn it into a much more accessible kind of entertainment where there are big critical things happening. There's not so many crises in Mrs. Dalloway, but here there are really important things like someone's going to die, someone's going to embezzle, so forth.
Right.
So there's a plot, a real set of different plots, and the machine works to integrate them as being in this one space, you know. That becomes a prototype, and people immediately see it as an interesting model for film. So, of course, Grand Hotel gets made. Another film that does the same thing is less famous is Skyscraper Souls, which is a very interesting film with multiple characters in a confined setting. But that gets picked up a lot in the 30s. So, I mean, there are quite a few films that mimic the Grand Hotel idea of small, constrained storytelling. It comes back in the 40s, like Weekend at the Waldorf is the best example, or Hotel Berlin, which is another Vicky Baum novel. It isn't so salient as it would be in the later years, in the 90s and 2000s, it's extremely common to have these kinds of things, kind of compacted narrative events. So it's something that was not as salient in the 40s as it was in other times, but it just shows, I think, that the awareness on the part of filmmakers to keep these narrative traditions alive, mm-hmm. you know, to try them in different ways. Later you get it with sort of hostage films, films where, you know, things are constrained by virtue of a single dramatic event holding everybody hostage. And that kind of comes out of Petrified Forest to some extent, mm. too. So there are variants of it, or films that take place in, like, on a train or something, yeah. you know, those kinds of things.
Sure.
So it's reverberations are felt. The Grand Hotel model gets felt in various ways, maybe not quite as explicitly as it had been in the 30s or would be much later.
Yeah, yeah. I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention Daisy Kenyon.
Yes.
I mean, you did a whole podcast on the film, or a good portion of the podcast with Peter Labuza was devoted to Daisy Kenyon.
Right.
If listeners have not yet heard that episode of The Cinephiliacs, they should go ahead and check it out after they're done listening to this, of course. But I know you and I both adore this movie. Mm. And just generally speaking, there's something... sort of something, I guess it's modernist. I think of it as modernist in that we never really know what any of the characters are thinking,
yeah.
right? It's totally withholding, right?
It's fantastic that
yeah.
way. I
yeah.
think there's a case where, I mean, in a way, you think about something like Casablanca, it's on the nose.
Yeah.
It's pretty much on the nose, you know, and that's fine because it's just about people's passions and so on. They say what they think and feel, though Rick represses certain things he feels, obviously, to punish Elsa. But in Daisy Kenyon, people are bluffing, or people are circumventing, people are not facing. I remember when I showed it in that very summer I mentioned, when we had one of those sessions I did in Belgium, the dominant reaction was, this is a completely modern movie, because these people seem to be like us. Mm-hmm. They don't know what they want, mm-hmm. and they're not honest with each other.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a fascinating take on it, because I do believe that's what Preminger is all about. Is about characters who dissemble, who are not sure what they want, but also are very good at hiding their vulnerabilities and putting up false fronts. I mean, all these things. And the interesting thing is that Preminger lets them retain a certain amount of that with respect to us, that we aren't given the privilege or salient things. At the very end of Daisy Kenyon, the Henry Fonda character, Peter, he says he's won.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He kind of has,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
When it comes to combat tactics, you're just yeah. a pair of babies. Yeah. And all the time you think he's the guy who they've been wiping their feet on throughout the whole movie.
Right.
But he got it. He got what he wanted.
Yeah.
And then she's pouring these two glasses of whiskey out like she knows one man is going to come back to her.
Mm-hmm.
Does she know which one?
Right.
Is she able to predict? Because she's banished them both.
Sure.
That she knows one's coming back.
Yeah.
Does she even care?
Right.
I mean, all these – this is just such a kind of existential gesture, like – whoever, you know,
yeah.
I give up,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
Or what, you know, I mean, there's an opacity to these characters. I mean, it's most obvious with Peter, who says these incredible non sequiturs. But at the same time, you get it with the Dana Andrews character, too, where he seems to be a complete weasel. And yet he suddenly takes on this pro bono case
right.
to defend, you know, an immigrant. And then later he says, I did it to make you love me.
Yeah.
But then later after that, he gives a very powerful, classic, liberal, social problem speech to her father when she's not around.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's a complexity to these, an inconsistency, an interesting inconsistency of these characters that doesn't seem the result of bad screenwriting or anything like that.
Yeah.
It really seems like these are complicated people.
Sure, yeah.
And Premer just lets them live that way.
Yeah.
Just lets them do it,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
I think that's a fascinating possibility.
Sure, yeah. And the style of the film really augments that ambiguity, right? And you obviously talk about the great shot where, after the car accident, where he just holds on her exiting the car.
She pulls back farther and farther and farther, like, okay, I gave you a little dose of what's like to be Daisy, you know, the ringing telephone in her head
yeah.
as she's driving.
Yeah.
This is my 40s scene. I'm going to give you a scene of, like, the haunted protagonist and the subjective sound. And then, okay, enough of that. Let's go back to objectivity,
yeah.
you know, and just pull away, and we're back to this game that people are playing with
yeah.
each other.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw that, I was watching it with my roommate, and I think I just turned to her and said, what are we watching? It was unbelievable.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating film. And this just came out like any other movie.
Yeah.
It's just another Joni movie, you know, another Fox film. There we go. Bang. You know, it's just quite incredible how that so many films like this are just out there. The other thing that's so fascinating to me, Pauline, is the critics at the time don't seem to notice this.
Yeah.
They were so steeped in this. And this is my theory anyway. They're so immersed in the weirdness that was 40s cinema that what seems weird to us didn't seem weird to them.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at all this. You have dead people talking, and you have people communing with each other across distances. You have all this stuff going on. And the reviewers just go, good performance by Rosalind Russell, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, just like, whatever, you know? So
yeah,
they're the same
yeah.
as the critics I'm complaining
sure,
about now. They
yeah.
don't seem at all curious about the peculiarities of these
sure,
things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's just, I don't know. I suppose that's true for us, too. I mean, I think it will take time for us to think about how strange superhero movies are, or how strange that Hollywood cinema should embrace this genre so passionately
sure.
when nobody buys comic books anymore.
True. Yeah.
You know,
no,
I mean, you know, it's just fascinating that you can kind of reinvent this whole comic book culture, but in an absence of comic book readers.
Absolutely.
It's quite
yeah.
strange.
Yeah, I try and think about that every time I walk out of a movie scratching my head, like, maybe I will come to appreciate the strangeness of this movie in time,
yeah,
or
yeah,
maybe it's yeah. doing something surprising that I'm just not aware of at the moment.
Yeah.
And
that's it. We can't see
yeah.
it because we're immersed in it.
Sure.
We can't see it. And
yeah.
now maybe that's one of the things about my book, is that maybe in the 40s, these movies, I think the things I'm pointing to are objectively there. I don't
yeah.
think I'm making this up. But I also think that it probably was so much a part of the fabric of movie going and cultural life at the time that people just, it didn't pop out to people.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like a great place to stop, but I feel like I would be letting my mother down if I didn't mention Random Harvest, which you talk about
oh,
in
I
your
like
book.
Oh, I like Random Harvest very much.
So, yeah, you point that out as an example of elliptical storytelling, right?
Yeah, we suddenly find out she's his
yeah,
secretary.
By the way.
Whatever, you know. No, that's
yeah.
a very good example of how, again, it's a matter of forced choice. It's not just about, do I have a flashback here or there, or do I have it at all? Rather, in this case, who do you attach your character to? I mean, to me, whenever you have two characters interacting and then they separate, there's a crucial choice. Who do we go with?
Mm-hmm.
You follow one or you follow the other? That's basic. You have to decide that. If you're writing a screenplay, you have to decide, am I with that person or am I with that person? And we assume that if you go with A rather than B, what happens with B is kind of inconsequential. Because, after all, A is the important character. And they're kind of, B is kind of floating on hold out there in some sort of limbo and not really doing that much. And then when A intersects with B again, they'll say, what's up? Oh, well, this happened, that happened. We'll get caught up. But when you follow A, as we do in that film, and then suddenly B pops up, you know, years later as their secretary,
sure.
And A doesn't remember B,
right.
You do have a pretty peculiar thing. Now, of course, it's all framed by B, you know,
right.
Telling the story.
Sure.
But
yeah.
She doesn't tell it in the most perspicuous way. She, in fact, tells the story in a way that suggests that you should be with her
right.
rather than with him.
Right, yeah.
So it's a fascinating but this is, again, putting all the pieces together. How many people really care or notice that?
Right.
It's
right.
There is a kind of idea of the innovations are always noticed. They're always picked up on, you know. But I think a lot of innovations just fly right by us.
Yeah.
You know, we either don't pay attention to them or we just take certain things for granted. Only when you start to look at them do they become peculiar.
Yeah. I mean, Random Harm is a perfect example. I mean, that's a movie that my mother has loved for years and has watched probably annually.
She's happy because it's on TCM every month.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, sure. but it's a movie that I probably dismissed when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It's not flashy in the way that Citizen Kane is flashy.
No, it's a grown-up movie for sure.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. That innovation comes in subtle forms as well as big bombastic forms, and it's worth paying attention to the subtle smaller techniques.
Well, also, because again, when we're talking about narrative, everything matters.
Yeah.
Everything that happens is important, and sometimes it's fine-grained, and sometimes it's big. And in fact, one of the things I think that people liked about Citizen Kane at the time and still like is it's big. Its innovations are in your face. And that makes it good for teaching,
mm-hmm.
but also makes it good historically because then people pick up off it. It's so obvious what it's doing in many respects, though I think there are plenty of subtleties in Citizen Kane too. But the certain things are so obvious that they'll influence people.
Mm-hmm.
They can pick up on them, and they did. But there are other kinds of innovation that's subtler and more complicated and is easy kind of miss because, again, you're used to the conventional part of the film and not the unconventional. One student came up to me once and said, a graduate student, I was speaking at Columbia, and a student came up and said, I think I've got you figured out. You're interested in the conventional parts of unconventional movies and the unconventional parts of conventional
that
movies. I said, that's sort of right. Yes, that's sort of what I do.
I like that. All right. Well, let that be a lesson to listeners. You know, pay attention. Just generally. okay, so let's...
It's the Yogi Berra line. You can learn a lot. You can observe a lot by watching.
Little Yogi. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, do you have any thoughts you'd like to share on Casablanca? Come let us know on our website, flickswise.com. Or you can drop us a note on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flickswise. And if it's more Joan Crawford talk you seek, you should probably come follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flickswise. But before you do all of that, please, please go to iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. Subscribe, rate us, and leave us a nice comment. If you don't, well, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but probably tomorrow. So you should just go ahead and do it now. Coming up on FlixWise, we have a John Cassavetes, Jenna Rowland double feature. We're talking Faces and Woman Under the Influence. And I believe we're going to do Colored Pomegranates pretty soon as well, so stay tuned. But until then, Professor, it has been an honor. As I mentioned at the top of the show, I've been doing this podcast for 4 years now, and never in a million years did I think... when I started that I would one day be sitting down with David Bordwell to talk Casablanca.
I know. You'll never be able to wash those hands again.
I don't know. This is pretty peak for me. It's pretty great. And just to give listeners a reminder, the book is called Reinventing Hollywood and is available on Amazon and I imagine wherever you can find a bookstore near you. possibly?
You would probably have to go to a bookstore fairly far from you to find a copy of this book.
Okay. All right. Stick to Amazon. and then do you want to tell listeners the name of your blog?
Oh, right. Yeah, we have a blog. It's at www.davidbordwell.net. It's called Observations on Film Art. Kristen Thompson and I, and sometimes others like Jeff Smith, contribute to it. And we try to put up something every week, 10 days, 12 days, something like that, on recent films, but also classic films, things that are happening in the Madison film culture, but also festivals we visit, visitors we've got coming. We'll do a blog on, probably do a blog on Damien Chazelle when he comes. He's coming to visit us this week, hopefully, fingers crossed. And when he comes, we'll try to give you a report on what he says and does.
All right. Wonderful. Okay, so listeners, make sure to stay tuned for that as well. And then shall we head off to the Congo? Or? All right. Take care, everyone.